You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Lynn Coffey. So, Lynn, it's good to have you here this morning.
Yeah, I'm pumped. I'm excited to talk.
Good. So, the way we begin the show is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities you aspire to live by, the values, the places you've been, the things you've done, the labels you wear? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
Yeah, wow. That has to be the world's largest question.
Yeah. Okay. So take a chisel and chuckle.
Yeah, all right. We'll just start picking things. I would just pick words that come to my mind. I think the coolest thing about who I am, from my perspective, is I'm super curious. I'm curious about people. I'm curious about why people do things the way they do them. I'm curious about how the world works. I'm curious about any hobby. Mm-hmm. So definitely curious and a little bit oddly traditional. I like things to be neat and organized and kind of follow rules. And But at the same time, I can get outside of the box on things.
Right.
So it's an interesting dynamic to live in as a human.
Well, I mean, but it makes a lot of sense to me because people, if your curiosity is you really want to engage other things and see them clearly, you have to have a base from which to operate.
Yes.
I love some that. Having some kind of structure that you're aware of and that you can adapt actually allows you to be curious rather than just reactive.
Right. And I love that. Yeah, that was like a little therapy session right there. That was fantastic. that's how I would perfectly describe it. So I have this base that I'm safe and I'm comfortable and I like how it is.
Right.
But I do like to reach out and figure out how other people live their lives or what's going on in the world or, you know, just why ants do what they do. You know, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then my labels are, I'm a foster parent, I'm an adoptive parent, a wife, a friend, you know, all those things. I'm a beginning beekeeper.
Uh-huh.
That's fun. I'm an entrepreneur. So I have lots of stuff going on.
Sure.
That is, you know, we were talking a bit
evidence
before.
Evidence of your curiosity.
Yeah, which is a curse sometimes because it's almost this never-ending fascination with things.
Well, and for me, what I've had to learn is that I have to take care of that base structure because if I don't, I get whipped. I just get completely wasted, exhausted, and I'm not good for human consumption.
So I'm just learning that. Yeah. So after years of people telling me that I basically stink at self-care,
right,
and me being like, but I don't, like, look, I do this, and this, and not getting what they're saying,
I
decided to take this year and not make any resolutions. You know, I'm not like a big resolution person anyway, but I was like, you know what? This year, I got to figure out self-care. And so I have been, and I've always enjoyed life, but this year has been so sweet. There's a depth to it. There's a peacefulness to it. There's a beauty to it. And I'm finally getting what people mean when they say self-care. Because previously it was like, okay, I'll take a yoga class. Like, check, I did self-care.
Right.
And it wasn't, obviously that wasn't meeting the mark.
right. You don't embody the practice of yoga, which is which is self-care as opposed to taking the class.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. But I thought I was.
Yeah.
No, but but all those loved ones kept saying, no, you kind of stink at this. So it has been a fascinating year. And that's part of how bees came into it. Because it was this thing that serves no purpose other than I was interested in it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I tend to only do things if there's a very specific purpose. And so I was like, all right, we're going to do this just because.
Uh-huh.
And it's been this great place that I can go and just spend, a few hours a week enjoying something just to enjoy it. And
sure.
That's a cool feeling.
Yeah, totally. I want to just take a moment to clarify something, maybe for the listeners, maybe that's already clear, but sometimes it's worth restating. You said this was a great little therapy moment when I reframed or gave a structure to something you were saying, and you were trying to. I thought you were trying to say that, and I just tried to concretize it. That's where I come from. That's visiting. And what we have lost as a culture is the capacity to reflect with each other in ways that take our curiosity about each other, explore it. We give back. Sometimes we're off the mark, but it's fine to be wrong. It's not bad to be wrong. And living in that kind of environment where visiting happens, we have more of a community.
Yes.
We learn to talk to each other. We learn to talk about our lives with each other in ways that are personal and not privately disclosing stuff that's not, that shouldn't be. But we are out there, and people, we need to know how to interact with people, and people need to know how to interact with us. And we learn by practicing. And visiting is the metaphor, or the visiting is the label that I like to put on it, because it's a practice that we've largely lost in this culture.
Yeah, that is one of the largest things I'm interested in. I find I constantly am trying to use your term, visit people.
Uh-huh.
And I can have generic, like, small talk with people, but it doesn't engage me. It doesn't fill that curiosity that I have as a person. And so I find that I'm always thinking up things I can do to meet people and talk to people and really like connect with, so I use the word connection.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, I feel like I'm constantly seeking that connection and wondering about that, you know, why am I seeking that? What is, what does it fulfill? And then larger questions, as you mentioned, how does that fit into our society, not only here in Ithaca, but, you know, in the US and of course, globally as well.
Yeah. And the notion of connection is also what's often meant behind the word spirituality, you know, and the connections in a spiritual person tend to emanate from them as the center of their perceptions as they're reaching out to the universe. But religion also does the same thing. It just tends to do so in more formal terms. And how we respond to those institutions or those informal spiritual practices are really, you know, it's also part of what we're seeking to discover that we've lost.
Yeah, I think spirituality or religion or just sitting around a dinner table with friends and having a potluck dinner, you know, I think we're all looking to belong. It's, you know, and I know that's not really anything new, but for me, it's taken on a new meaning, especially being a foster parent, you know, and learning about the world of trauma and toxic stress and all this stuff. In the end, we're all really just looking, myself included, are just looking to make a connection to feel valued and wanted and special and unique and part of something. And I think for me, that's part of the human existence that I'm, as you mentioned, I'm wondering if it's getting a little lost along the way.
Right. And here's where the concept of belonging, has had a kind of a positive and a negative history. The negative history is when you belong, then you're owned. You're owned by your family or your institution or your profession or whatever. And we don't want to be owned. We want to have connection. We want to have a place of our own and to be in relationship with others. And that sense of belonging is more something that we negotiate. But it's not something that we absolutely define, because others around us define it too. And learning to negotiate in that awkward space, you know, it defies easy answers.
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to what I said. I'm like oddly traditional, but not because it's that same feeling. I want this security and family and friends and all this stuff, right?
Right.
But I don't want to be, using your terms, owned or made to change who I am to fit what they require or need.
Right.
So it is this really interesting time where I want traditional things, but I also want to be me and free. And what does that mean? And, you know, you add that curiosity layer and it's a fun place to be a lot of times.
Yeah. And I will honor your needs. And in as much as I can, I will meet them, but I will not be defined by them.
Right.
And that's, you know, we've gotten much more philosophical and spiritual very quickly in the show than usual. What music would you brought music with you? What would you like to open with, and would you like to say anything about it?
Yeah, I think I want to start with a song by Melissa Ferrick. It's called Anything Anywhere, and this song reminds me of my grandmother, who was the most important person in my life, and so you know, she might come up during our conversation but I'll just kind of say that about the song and go from there.
Okay, here we go.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Smile when I call your name. I want you
never look at anyone else this way. So strange, there's something we have between us, and it's not fair. If you've never loved this way, anything, anywhere, I would give everything I own away. Always I will sing, picturing you singing right back to me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest on this hour is Lynn Coffey. So Lynn, what the life that you value now, the change and the change that you've made in the past year to slow down, be a little more intentional and grounded. That's my reinterpretation of what you said, because I can't remember right now what the words you used. But the life you value now, what did you have to learn in order to take on the challenge of living it, of the life you value now?
Oh, what a, God, that's a great question. So I, right now, my life, and I'll use sort of, just sort of like generic, I don't know if generic's the right word, but I'll just sort of use a couple words to describe the overall picture of my current life. It's nice, middle class, live in Fall Creek, Ithaca, you know, married to the most beautiful partner, three kids, you know, run up my own business. Mm-hmm. It's nice. It's very nice. That's a great word for it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
However, growing up, I had a crazy childhood. I've been shot at. I have had to go in hiding for a week. I lived in I think last count was like 33 different homes by the time I hit like 25 or something. Wow. Like that. You know, my mom had me when she was 16. Lots of like seeing drugs and drug deals and abuse of all sorts. And so I lived this weird, crazy childhood that was not stable. And, you know, in saying that, the song that we just listened to, I had mentioned, reminds me of my grandmother. She was this sweet spot in my life. And she was just, she just adored me and thought the world of me, and I knew it and I felt it. And she was definitely my person. Uh-huh. And so she was sort of this constant soft place to land. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in growing up how I did, it was needed and it was required. And I'm so thankful that I had that, because I don't know that if I didn't have that, I don't know if I'd be able to have the life I do have now.
Right.
And so one of the things that I've had to learn was that I've created this life and it's okay for me to stop trying to be better or to create better. Like,
it's good enough.
It's good enough.
Right.
And that has been my biggest lesson this year, because I am someone who, I'm not a perfectionist in the way that we traditionally use the word, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I'm a perfectionist in that I have extraordinarily high standards for myself.
Your perfectionism is not about the outcome, but it's about the continuous growth.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's a different...
Yeah, beast. That's... And it never ends, right? Yeah. And
it's
so,
like being haunted.
Yeah, right. And so there was always this duality of like, wow, look how far I've come and look at all that I've been able to accomplish in life. But it's nowhere near the end, right. And it's exhausting. And, you know, when I started to have children, it, you know, they take up a lot of time. I don't know. Yep. And suddenly my time for doing all of these self-growth things became very limited. Mm-hmm. And I found myself kind of getting frustrated. Like, how am I supposed to become this better human and do all of these things, mm-hmm, when I have three little kids and I have just this life? And my life started to become like almost like a burden in a way. Like, I loved it and it was beautiful, but it felt like it got in the way of me becoming like my journey to becoming this better person. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I really just this year have finally been able to flip that and say, wait a minute, like, I'm a really great person as I am. And I still have goals and things I want to work on. I'm not perfect, and nor will I ever be. And it's just, mm-hmm, again, with that word perfectionism, I sometimes take a little, it doesn't fit perfectly in the traditional sense. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But wow, like, I've created this beautiful life and it's okay for me to enjoy it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that has been one of the things that I think my grandmother and in my childhood sort of combined have helped me learn. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely been one of the toughest things for me to kind of put down that self-growth piece and just say, it's good.
Right, yeah. Right. And I want to go back, because this image of your grandmother, it strikes a chord with me in some ways. I grew up in rural poverty. Somebody lowered the barrel of a 12-gauge shotgun at me at one point. And I was nearly run off the road in the middle of the night for having challenged some people in town. I have a little bit of a taste, not the chaos of 30 places to live, but a little bit of a taste of what it's like. Yeah. How did your grandmother look at you? Do you remember, and how was that looking at you or gazing at you different than other people? And how did she talk to you in a way that was more memorable or somehow stuck with you to create that soft space?
Yeah, I appreciate the question, because it's nice to remember that. My family adores me and loves me and, mm-hmm, always has. So I, you know, saying
but
that.
But we're singling out one person.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I mentioned that because... But they were also just trying to get through their lives. Mm-hmm. And so I was this really quiet, great kid, great in school, didn't have any needs. You, mm-hmm, know, I didn't want to make anybody's life harder,
right,
than it already was. Yeah. So my existence was very quiet and just kind of like in the corner. Yeah. And so my family went on with their lives and I was there and they were nice and kind to me. But they were very busy with other things.
Yeah, they didn't know. You got lost.
They didn't know
I
got lost.
You were the first,
yeah,
child. You're the oldest.
I am the oldest. Yeah. And they didn't know I got lost. Absolutely. Yeah. But my grandmother, there was just, you know, this connection that we had always had. And so she would express in many different ways, just by always wanting to be with me. And by doing I was at her house almost every weekend. And every weekend we baked a cake. And it was just a simple you know, cheap generic store bought, you know, store bought brand from a mix. It wasn't like, you know, we're making our own frosting. Or, it was literally dumping a box in, cracking some, you know, that kind of a thing. But she spent that time with me. She was the one that when I was sick at school would pick me up, and it wasn't a burden to her. She wanted to be there. She wanted to, you know, cover me up in a blanket and give me ginger ale for an upset belly. You could tell that she wanted to do those things. But the biggest thing were her words matched her actions. And by that I mean, she was this huge bingo fanatic. I think she went at her height, she was going 5 days a week, you know. And she would take me anytime I wanted to go. And she would just constantly talk to me or talk with all of her friends about me. And the words that she would use were, you know, how kind I am and how great of a kid I am. And I'm so patient and I'm so good in school. And so I would verbally hear somebody talking about me in such a nice way. But then her friends knew all about me. They knew all about my life. So it was very clear that she talked about me all the time and they told me.
And she opened a community for you.
And I mean, I didn't really play bingo most of the time. Sometimes I did. But just little things like that, you know, if we were to go to the grocery store, right next to the grocery store was a little like pet place where you could like buy chameleons and rats and gerbils, you know. And almost every time that I would go with her, she would let me come home with something. And, you know, growing up also, you know, poverty line, that whole thing. You know, there was not a lot of extra money for even a McDonald's Happy Meal, let alone this living, you know, little gerbil or this hermit crab. So little things like that that she would do just really, again, her words and her actions lined up. And in my life at that time, there was not a lot of that going on. And it was confusing for me. You know, I specifically remember my dad. He's this great philosopher, but he's basically a recluse. He's an alcoholic and a, you know, drug addict. And he would literally be chugging beers, drunk as a skunk, and being like, don't drink. Don't do what I'm doing. You know, and it was, and he would add all these, but he had these beautiful life lessons about how to make friends and how to have integrity. I mean, he had these beautiful life lessons, but his actions, he couldn't live those. And it was so confusing. He couldn't
walk through the door of living them.
And he knew it, you know, which is a whole other subject. But so, yeah, my grandmother was just a constant. You know, I called a soft space. I just always knew she was there. And I knew, I just knew she was just enamored with me. And it was so nice to be seen.
And what I call being beheld. She, when you, she looked at you, you knew that you, she was beholding you. And that's a quality that the old men, my dad died when I was young. And so the old men in town who were born in the 1880s and 1890s and early 1900s, when I was a kid in the 60s, they would behold you when they were sitting along Main Street and watching and talking to people. And they knew my grandparents and great grandparents, and some of them my great great grandparents. It was just that kind of connection, which is powerful.
Yeah, it's really powerful. And I think it's just, it's one of the things. So my grandmother passed in 2008, and in that song that we, you know, listened to a few minutes back, just took on a whole new meaning because some of the words, and I think actually the artist wrote the song about her nieces. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I heard that somewhere. But there are just certain lines, you know, that after my grandmother passed, it was, you know, that song was just so special. So yeah, I like that word, beholding.
So let's transition. What music should we play next? And also, you know, we'll pick up a new thread.
I don't. Let's do some John Denver. Let's do Annie's song.
Here we go.
You fill up my senses like a night in a forest, like the mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert,
like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me again. Come let me love you, let me give my life to you. Let me drown in your laughter, let me die in your arms. Let me lay down beside you, let me always be with you. Come let me love you, come love me. Like the mountains in springtime, like a walk in the rain, like a storm in the desert, like a sleepy blue ocean. You fill up my senses, come fill me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Lynn Coffey. So Lynn, your mother reinforced, I mean, your grandmother reinforced your notion of being kind, but where did that character attribute come from? Is that something you've always had, or is that something you cultivated? And because it comes across in the way you talk about the chaos and the violence and implied violence of your upbringing. How did that become a touchstone for you? And how? Yeah, and I have other questions about how have you learned to be firm and perhaps mean even as you're trying to be kind? Because the balance of being kind and being resolute is often very hard.
Yeah. I don't know. I struggle because my friends and family and people who know me would describe me as kind.
Right.
But growing up, I certainly was kind. I was I was a great kid. But inside was rage and chaos
and turmoil. And
anger and yeah. It just never really came out.
Right.
And for lots of reasons. But one of the things that I realized early on, and it's I thank TV for it, is I would watch TV and go, okay, that's what a family is supposed to look like. Oh, that's what a friendship is supposed to look like. Oh, that's how you get into a disagreement with somebody. Like if we're talking about like a half hour sitcom
sure.
show, you know, oh, they just got into a disagreement and look how they worked through that.
Sure.
And so I would watch TV and I would always joke around, you know, like Dr. Phil's my daddy, you know, he at the time was kind of maybe the height of his career, I don't know, but he had this new show and he was talking about things like integrity and all this stuff. And I was just fascinated by it because it's like, here's how to be a good person. And I, you know, I had my dad telling me all these life lessons, but again, it wasn't matching up with the actions. Right. And it was kind of like, well, is that stuff fake? And then, so TV presented this whole world of how I could possibly live.
Right.
And I started to integrate those things as much as I could in my life. So meaning I studied hard. If I said I was going to do something, I did it. Mm-hmm. Those characteristics that I had control over. In terms of the question about how do you be firm but still set boundaries and mm-hmm. be kind and those kind of things, I struggled with that quite a bit. Because when I hit my 20s and became more of an adult out on my own and wasn't part of necessarily the family dynamics as much as when I was like 10, mm-hmm. My natural inclination was just to withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not around it. Don't right. need to deal with it. I'm gone kind of a thing.
Right, right.
Even though I was still connected to my family, but
you're not living in it.
I'm not living in it, yeah. right? And so it was like less chaos, so I'm happy with this. But then as I started to have kids and I wanted my kids to meet these amazing family members and have a family of their own,
mm-hmm.
it was something that I had to start grappling with. Well, how can I connect with my family still and have it so that my kids don't have any of my baggage and know necessarily about, because they're little, they're only four, mm-hmm. two, and right. one. How can I not taint that experience for them?
Right.
And, but also keep my sanity. mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's a difficult thing to do. And so a lot of it has just been about communicating, but communicating in a way that for my family is not usual for them. So for example, just communicating, an example is not coming to mind, but, please don't give tons and tons of sugar to my kids. I mean, that's right. kind of a bad yeah. example, but, and I remember my mom just being like, well, I'm the grandma. I get to do whatever I want.
Right.
But my kids have some issues where sugar really ramps them up, like really, really mm-hmm. ramps mm-hmm. them up. And then we have self-regulation problems. And so it's beyond just, I don't want my grandma to give right. kids sugar. Right. So, but sitting down and kind of explaining that
right.
and saying, this is what we can come up with, a plan.
Mm-hmm.
You could ask me ahead of time before you just give him something or whatever the case would be.
Right.
But it was about talking in a tone that was of leadership.
Right. I love you and I want you in my life, but I want you to talk with me about how these kids are growing up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for me, it was taking that leadership role was mm-hmm. very different because I had spent my whole childhood
you
just being
up.
In the corner,
yep.
even though I've been a leader my entire life. Right.
Yeah.
But not necessarily with my family.
Right.
And, so to step into that role was an interesting and difficult thing to do because people weren't used to me stating any sort of a need.
Right.
And
right.
so they had to get used to that. When it's different, it was a change of dynamic.
Right.
Like, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, we're going to do it my way like we've always done it. And it was negotiating that and having hard conversations, which, we kind of talked about at the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of being in relationship with people. Right. And it's an okay thing to do. And it's a part of any relationship.
Yeah. Families and communities that fail don't allow people to change.
Yes.
They want to keep them frozen in the roles that they are in. And that just creates enormous, unresolvable conflict.
Yeah.
Whereas the conflicts that are deeply painful, that are productive, allow us to change.
Mm-hmm.
And we make some choices about our changes, but other people make choices about the change, the environment that we're in that we don't control. And learning how to navigate that is just, it's incredible. So you've become a leader in your family. In that way, how many siblings do you have? How many?
I actually have six brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. But we are, and I say this, lovingly, but we are a trailer park, kind of white trash kind of family. So we have lots of half siblings, and people don't talk to people, there are lots of crazy family dynamics. And one of the interesting things for me has always been. I actually talk and get along with everybody,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of an unusual place to be in. And so in order to keep all these relationships, part of that strategy has been we're not going to talk bad about so-and-so.
Right.
We're not going to do that. We're just going to talk about you and me and our lives and our dreams and our mm-hmm. whatever it's going to be.
Right.
And so It's been a really interesting growth and lesson to learn, I think, right. in dynamics.
Right, right. And it's also more of an emphasis on focusing on the struggle and the hope rather than the pain and its cause.
Yeah.
Which gets into a lot of blaming oftentimes.
Yeah. And I don't know, I've been blessed that for some reason people don't have those conversations a lot with me. It always seems to focus on the hope and what we're working on and what we want to accomplish and all of those things. And that's been, and it's been great to see, you know, like I'm thinking of, you know, my siblings and my cousins who grew up similar to me. And it's great to see that most of them have achieved goals mm-hmm. and, you know, they're beyond what you would expect of them if you were to, you know, read the story of their childhood.
Right.
And I think that's a really cool dynamic that my family has, that it's interesting. And again, it appeals to the curiosity part right. of me of like, right. well, how did that happen? Why did that happen? And what was that difference?
And let me digress for a second here. The quality of loving kindness, which is what you're describing, in the Hebrew term, it's hesed. And it was historically translated into English as loving kindness, but its literal meaning is covenant loyalty. Mm. You know, and we have a covenant, which is a vow to look after each other's well-being and the loyalty to hold on to that. Mm. And that tends to keep us on the positive.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting way that you have framed your relationship. My family, my dad's death sent us down from being precariously on the lower middle to upper low, poor class to something that my older siblings don't recognize. I'm the sixth of seven survivors, seventh of eight born kids. And so I got to see kind of both sides. And when I describe myself as coming from white trash, my older siblings just absolutely revolt.
Right.
You know, it's just, they will not, you know, they will not own that. But I do it partly to push their buttons, but also partly to say that in my school, I could talk with anyone, be with anyone, regardless yes. of their social class or status or.
Yeah. And I think it's okay to talk about those things
yeah.
and use those labels in ways, you know, in referring to myself with some humor.
Yeah.
And I think it does embody a culture, you know, the, was it J.D. Vance wrote a book, Hillbilly
right.
Elegy,
right.
you know, and I read that and was like, totally get it. And kind of like cracking up things really that people who haven't gone through that maybe won't laugh at. But I grandfather sitting there in suspenders and chewing tobacco, and you know, the front yard is a junkyard and it's all scrap metal. I mean, I find beauty in it because it's how I grew up, and it taught me so much about life. And there's a depth to me mm-hmm. that I living in Ithaca, sometimes it's difficult for me because. I can't get to a level of deepness with some people mm-hmm. that I'm looking for.
Right.
It's
politeness
it's,
gets in the way.
Oh God, yes.
Yeah. And in that sense, mm-hmm. culture is the enemy of relationship.
Yes.
yeah. In that sense of social class and politeness. So I want to go on to some other things before we move on. What should we play next musically?
Okay, let's do a song by 311 called Amber.
Okay. Here we go.
Song.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Lynn Coffey. So Lynn, the very real and understandable anger and rage and turmoil that was you were processing inside and trying to find a way to manage as a child, what happened to that? How did you address that? How do you address that in your life?
Yeah, that's been a tough one. A lot of personal development stuff.
Mm-hmm. Self-help with Dr. Phil.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Just watching TV fixes it. So a lot of that and figuring out who I am, what I want, trying to figure out the logic behind it, which it was successful to a point. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, nature has played an incredible role my entire life. Mm-hmm. And so spending lots of time in the woods, hiking by myself, staring at creeks and just allowing that, which is now I know a form of meditation, mm-hmm. a form of just kind of letting go and being mindful. That has helped me so much. But the biggest thing that has really tipped the scales was when I started learning about trauma, toxic stress, and all of that, mm-hmm. and how it does change neurological pathways in the brain, sure. and all this stuff. And I started learning about it all because my kids, I don't think I mentioned it, but all my kids started as foster children and either are adopted or will be adopted here within the next few months. And, you know, so some they have some struggles and issues and behaviors, and it was like, what's going on? Why is this happening? And so I learned about all of that. And so tools, and one of the tools that we got was the acronym PACE. It stands for playfulness, acceptance, curiosity, and empathy. Mm-hmm. And I have the curiosity part down, like, mm-hmm. why is this kid doing this or whatever? I had the empathy part down because I, you know, could feel like that when you feel all crazy and chaotic or sad and depressed and you have no outlet. Mm-hmm. So I felt that. The acceptance piece was a little tricky because remember, I always have these high standards for myself. So it's like, nope, if we lower the bar, that means, you know, nope, we
You're
have to raise
doing
the
what
bar.
You could be doing.
Exactly. Right. So that's a little tricky. But the playfulness piece was interesting because it allowed me to almost relive my childhood as I would want to relive it.
Uh-huh.
So instead of just being quiet in the corner, I get to be down on the floor, tickling my kids, having a good time. And I know I'm parenting them, but I'm kind of reparenting my inner mm-hmm. child.
Right.
And that has been really helpful from getting me beyond just like traditional, like, you know, take a weekend workshop on blank, you know, to moving into actually feeling kind and believing that I'm kind and believing that core of who I am is not this angry person. Because for the long time, it was like, oh, I have anger. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it defines me. And I have to hide that.
Right. And but there's also nothing wrong with anger when because mm-hmm. anger is a signal. Anger is a way of telling yourself and others that something's got to be addressed here.
And I never got that till this year. Okay. I was constantly trying to hide, like not, I was trying to constantly get rid of it.
Yeah.
Like that was possible, yeah. you know, but I was like on this quest to never be mad or sad or angry.
Right. And to not be comfortable with it.
Right.
Yeah. I come from an environment where comfort with conflict, it's a high conflict environment. So comfort with it. So people perceive me as even more angry than I may be.
Yes.
Because I have a very high tolerance right. for conflict.
Right.
And that's a problematic.
Right. Well, plus I'm Italian, so I speak loud. My family's, my mom's a fiery redhead, Sicilian, you know, like
yeah.
So you add all this together and yeah, you put me up with somebody that's, you know, quiet and gentle and had a great upbringing and it I think it can take people a little bit of time to get the sarcasm and the depth and
right.
you know, all that stuff. So anyway,
right. That's neat. And I'm gonna take this a slightly different direction because when you are parenting your children and you're actually reparenting yourself in the way you talked about it, my belief is that we firmly have to learn things viscerally and relearn them viscerally. And for me, my standard for truthfulness, is it intellectually accurate? Is it emotionally honest? And is it viscerally compelling? If it doesn't fire on all three, then there's something wrong. There's something wrong with it. Most public policy fails to be viscerally or emotionally connected. Most intellectual work fails to do this. Most academic work. We need to live fully human lives, which has to in some sense work on all three. And that your response to coming to terms with your anger and the chaos of your upbringing and reparenting yourself sets up the last question of the show in a way that I had never really thought about. So how do you now, in this past year where you've seen anger as a signal and where you're reparenting yourself as you parent your child, how are you taking care of yourself further emotionally, intellectually, and physically throughout the day and, you know,
yeah.
over the week?
I do lots of things now. So for example, every week, no matter what, I have a breakfast date with my wife.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that, you know, is just sort of non-negotiable. That's something I do. I often take walks around town. I live right downtown and I work from home, which is great, you know, but there's also lots of issues with that. I don't see a lot of people.
Right. You don't get out.
I don't get out. Right. So for somebody seeking connection and curiosity, I if I'm not careful, I get lost
in the base.
I get lost. Yeah, absolutely. So I will just do random walks around town and I'll do little things like I'll make a game. Like I need to make eye contact with everybody I pass on the sidewalk
mm-hmm.
And say hi,
right.
you know, or little things like that. So where I can get out, feel part of a community and get that connection, even on that little level that I need. But I mentioned beekeeping. Mm-hmm. I read a ton. So a lot of things like that I do. I think overall, though, the biggest thing is I've slowed down my brain. And I like what you said, you have to feel it viscerally. And I mentioned this earlier, but up until this year, it was like, what do you mean? I'm doing self-care. I don't feel any better, but I'm doing this, you know, checkbox thing.
Mm-hmm.
But this year, actually, I'm not quite sure what happened or what caused me to make the switch, but I was able to feel it viscerally.
Hmm.
And that has made all the difference because I'm a very logical person. So, you know, again, go to yoga. That should be self-care. Check. And I'd feel great after yoga or whatever it would be. But I wasn't allowing it to seep within, you know, the marrow of the bones and just feeling that until this year. And so those are some of the things that I do, but really it has been what we talked about. It has been the words and the actions and the belief that it's good mm-hmm. as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I can always do something different or change something, but it all doesn't have to get done right now by noon.
Right.
And, or next week.
Right.
It can, I can take time and take a 20-minute walk to a waterfall.
Right.
I can take time to just go to a cafe and order a lavender latte because I love it.
Right.
And I don't need a logical explanation to make it okay.
Right. Right.
And so I think learning to enjoy life, like really enjoy life with no logical agenda, has been really magical for me.
And one of the things that I hear in your story, and maybe I projected a little bit, those of us who grew up in somewhat chaotic environments without reliable parenting, when we self-parent ourselves as children, we're the harshest parents we could ever have.
Yeah.
And learning how to lighten up is a huge life task for those of us who've gone through that kind of trauma.
Yeah. And I can lighten up with others easily.
Lightening up with oneself is wholly different.
Right. It was a lightening up with myself. Right. Because it was like, no, I'm not going to go get a latte. I have work to do. I have to grow this business. I have to do X, Y, and Z.
And it's lightening up also with your intimate partner.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hard for me. I'm twice divorced, partly because I couldn't figure that out.
Nah.
And you were telling a story when we were off air about what you're, so one of the things you're proud of is that even having separated from a first marriage, divorced from a first marriage, you still have a wonderful friendship with that person.
Yeah. Yeah. I was saying that the song I played earlier, Annie's song, was actually my wedding song of my first marriage, which lots of people might find that a little odd or like, oh my God, what does her current wife think about it? But for me, saying vows that I would love and care for somebody and being able to still do that, through a divorce, and even, you know, this is now like, you know, 5-6 years after the divorce, and she's still one of my best friends and one of the closest people to me, and she, you know, loves my kids and they love her, and it's just one of the most beautiful relationships in my life, because there's been a realness to it. Mm-hmm. There's been good times, there's been bad times, but it's something I've personally been proud of, because I think lots of people would have just been like, oh, this happened, I'm done, this person's X, Y, and Z. But I think for me, it was living in integrity, like, okay, like, let's not define an entire person by a couple of actions or a couple of feelings or whatever the case
would
be. Or even
2 years of your life, you know,
absolutely.
When you had more than,
Absolutely. So for me, it was about, this is hard and it was an unwanted change, but living a childhood as I did, I was very used to change and things that I didn't like or want. And so when it happened, I was really able to sit back and be like, how can we do this and go through this and still come out on the other side with a friendship and integrity intact? And I'm just really proud of myself that I was able to kind of do that.
And I'm deeply impressed, because that is something that I was not able to do after a 25-year relationship, or after a shorter relationship that was a rebound relationship. So it's a very, you know, but I think I'm in the space now where living with that quality of integrity is possible.
Yeah.
In the process of divorcing, when did you discover that intention?
Well, I think what had happened is I had said, all right, this is hard. So let's just not talk to each other. Like, let's just kind of make this a clean break.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we did.
Right.
And that's important, because I think when somebody states a need like that, no matter how hard it is for even the other person, it's really important that
it's
you
clear.
Hear the need
yeah.
and that you respect that person's mm-hmm. need. Because if you don't, then you have this problem of, well, I just said I needed this and you didn't meet my need, and it will continue the problems.
Right.
And so I was able to state a need. My ex was able to hear the need and respect that, and we didn't contact each other. And I remember after 30 days, and it wasn't like I'd set out for 30 days, but I remember it was 30 days, and I was walking around town and I was like, I'd really like to have lunch with her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called her up and she answered, which is also very important.
Mm-hmm.
And you could hear the trepidation in her voice. Like, right. Am I going to get yelled? Oh, it's happening.
you can begin to, you can change.
Right.
Yeah.
So she wasn't sure if I was going to be yelling, or she just wasn't sure. And you could hear that in the voice. And I said, what are you doing? And she said, nothing. And I said, you want to have lunch? And she said, okay. And so we met up and we had lunch. And that began us starting a friendship that we, it was a very new thing, you know, and it has to be.
And the so past lots has of to go away it on has some to, level.
Yeah. And that, and I just, it was just one of the most beautiful things. It was a divorce, but it was one of the most beautiful things.
And it was not complicated by children.
Yeah, that's correct.
Which also allows that to, I mean, there's it makes it a little easier.
Yes.
It doesn't, but it often, maybe even most of the time, doesn't happen, even without children.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we were certainly lucky in the sense that no children were part of that. I think it's just one of those things where even when someone states a need or integrity or when it's hard, it's okay that it's hard.
Right.
I'm really good with that. But I think it takes, it was just this beautiful dynamic of what a relationship, any relationship should be, even in hard times. And I think that's why it's so special. Because I just feel like it's such a rarity, especially in my life.
Lynn, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Yeah, thank you. You too.
And what should we close the show with?
Let's pick a Dave Matthews Band song called Satellite. Just a good chill out song.
Here we go.
Satellite in my eyes, like a diamond in the sky. How I wonder, satellite strong from the moon. Satellite headlines read someone's secrets. You've seen eyes and ears have been. Satellite dish in my eye. Tell me more, tell me more. Who's the king of your satellite castle? Winter's cool. Thank you.
satellite in my eyes, like a diamond in the sky. How I wonder, satellites come from